Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hello, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and I am the founder of Feminist Book Club. How are you doing? It feels like that question holds a lot more weight these days, doesn't it? I hope you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy and content. I want this space, our content, to be a safe escape from all of the pandemic news, though. So our social media and this podcast will continue to be trigger-free as we have enough to worry about. That said, my guest and I do briefly refer to the current global crisis in today's episode, but we do so with a lot of hope. The book we're discussing, Village of Scoundrels, has some feel-good parallels to what we're experiencing now, so it's an excellent one to read at this time. We are also giving away a signed copy, so be sure you check out the show notes for the link to enter to win that. We'll throw in some Feminist Book Club goodies as well, as we always do. Our April boxes begin to ship next week, and can I pack one for you? I've got gloves, and I'll be wearing a bandana over my face, so we will do this as germ-free as possible at the moment. I have personally been self-quarantined for 15 days now, so rest assured, there's very low risk here, so I'd love to pack a box for you. We are keeping it lighthearted with our book of the month. It is a queer YA novel about witches called These Witches Don't Burn by Isabel Sterling. In addition to the book, box subscribers will receive reusable silicone straws from Go Silly, plantable paper pulp full of wildflower seeds from Elysian Cedar, botanical facial serum from Sweet Girl Farm, and a pin from Alessi that says Dangerous Well-Read Woman. As always, we will donate 5% of all of our sales to charity, and our April charity of the month is called We Do, which stands for Women's Environment and Development Organization. We Do was founded by Congresswoman Bella Abzug and feminist activist slash journalist Mim Kelber in 1991. This intrepid organization works hard to bring a gendered lens to environmental issues, mobilizing 50 women from 31 states to form the UN International Policy Action Committee just last year. As a result of structural inequality, women are often more directly and more severely impacted by climate change and environmental issues. So, We Do works tirelessly to exemplify what our world must do to incorporate women and marginalized genders into these discussions. We Do provides training and advising for governments, organizations, and leaders around the world. Additionally, they advocate for and disseminate important and inclusive knowledge products to a global community. So if you're interested in learning more about We Do, go to wedo.org. And remember, a nickel of every dollar you spend at feministbookclub.com in the month of April will go back to them. So check out our shop too. The last day to get your April box for our reduced $42 a month price is April 5th. So head on over there now. We'll start shipping those out next week. Stay tuned for my conversation coming up next with Margie Preuss, author of the middle grade historical fiction novel Village of Scoundrels. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Today, I'm sitting down with Margie Preuss. Margie is a New York Times bestselling author of the Newbery Honor book, Heart of a Samurai, the Minnesota Book Award winning West of the Moon, and several other books for young readers, including the Enchantment Lake Mystery Series and two new titles in 2020, The Littlest Voyager and Village of Scoundrels. Her books have landed on many best of lists, have been honored as ALA ALSC Notables, selected as an NPR Backseat Book Club pick, chosen for community reads, and translated into several languages. At home in Duluth, Minnesota, she likes to hike, ski, paddle, or sit quietly with a book in her lap. She is one of us. Welcome, Margie.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me.
I am so honored to talk to you. I read your upcoming book, Village of Scoundrels, and I can't wait to talk more about it. But I have to ask everybody, what is your definition of feminism?
Well, I guess it's empowerment. A belief in empowerment, especially for those who lack it. of course, I'm old enough to be a second wave feminist. And so it's been very interesting to watch the kind of evolution of feminism over my lifetime. I was, a junior in high school when Title IX passed. And yeah, I was, 15 years old when a women's strike for equality occurred. So I've seen the whole thing from beginning of second wave on. And it's really interesting and kind of inspiring, really, to see what's happened.
What's been the most surprising in terms of the feminist movement over the years for you?
You know, I actually think it's a funny thing. A big part of it was back in those days was for women to not be seen as sex objects. And so for a lot of us, it's kind of confusing to see women who are really, you know, putting their sex out there and making dressing and behaving in ways that we fought so hard to not have to do to be seen as, you know, just regular people, you know, like human beings. And so I think for a lot of us, that's kind of been a challenge. Yeah, I just kind of watch it and think about it. I think it's been interesting to mull on a lot of the aspects that have changed and how individualized feminism has become. People take it on in an individual framework, like what it is to them as an individual rather than as a group, which is probably where it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just talked to Andy Zeisler about that too, that we're seeing this kind of proliferation of individual feminism and every choice I make is a feminist choice because now I can make choices. And it's like, pump the brakes there. There's still, you know, the good of the whole is something we should be fighting for as well. So yeah, I really am always interested to ask our elders, what's been the biggest changes and the biggest surprises. So thank you for sharing that. I know that you voiced some concern that your books aren't necessarily feminist books, but I would disagree. I think there's always, when a feminist writes a book, there's always an underlying element of strong women in these books.
Well, I forget who said that all literature is political, but I do agree with that. And of course, my morality, my own way of looking at the world shines through and informs what I'm writing about. First of all, what I want to write about, the characters I choose to write about. And I agree. It's there.
I want to talk a little bit about Village of Scoundrels. Now, when does this come out?
It actually came out February 25th.
Perfect. So it is available now, and we will leave a link in the show notes because it is fantastic. This is based on a true story of the French Resistance during World War II. Can you tell me a little bit about the story, the characters, and what brought you to these stories?
Well, I will tell you, yes. In 2016, I was in a very low place. Let's just say it was after the election. We'll just put that out there. And I felt like I think a lot of writers did, what do I do now? What do I do? I almost felt like I couldn't write. And so I cast about for a long time. And then I remembered this little snippet of a story that I had heard, or not heard, but read somewhere when I was researching another World War II novel that I wrote, also based on a true story of resistance in Norway during World War II. And the snippet that stuck in my head was about this French village that sheltered Jewish children during the war. And for the first years of the war, they didn't have any policemen living in their community, so they could get away with quite a lot. But the police in the valley, in the city in the valley, heard that they were sheltering Jewish children. And so they would send policemen up to hunt for them. And when that happened, they usually got a warning and the villagers would send the children out into the forest to hide. And when the gendarmes, the French police, went away, the village children would go out into the forest and sing a little song to let the hidden children know it was safe to come back. And so this story came back to me when I was wondering what I should write about. And I thought, you know, I spend a lot of time with my characters when I write a novel. It takes me quite a long time because I also do a lot of research. And also I'm a slow writer.
And I thought that surprises me with your, you know, body of work. Just hear you.
Well, I feel as if I'm a slow writer, maybe. So I thought, you know, I really want to spend my time with good people doing the right thing. And so I went and did a lot more research and just dug around to find where was this French village and read, you know, there are books written about it. It is a known place, and there are several nonfiction books written for adults, and there are a couple of nonfiction books written for children. This is the first novel for young readers written about it. And what I discovered when I was doing research was that a lot of the people who were involved in this rescue effort were teenagers. And of course, many of the rescued children and teens, you know, also were in that age category, because the reason they had all these Jewish children is because during the early parts of the war, it was legal to take children out of French concentration camps if their parents would let them go, and if there was somewhere to take somebody, some place where they could go. And so this village just started taking children. And then it was, as I mentioned, for a little while that part of France was not yet occupied by the Germans, it was legal to do this. But as soon as the Germans kind of gripped the whole of France, then these children were illegal. They were no longer legally allowed to be outside the concentration camp. And that's when my story starts. So that's when things really heat up and get dangerous for everyone.
And we start with the police officer character, the inspector. And I think it's so interesting, some of your word choices in the first 10 pages, that you are using phrases like illegals and undesirables for the inspector to describe these children. And I thought that was so interesting.
Well, that's interesting because those are not my choice of words. Those are the choice of words at that time. So, I mean, I have to say that over and over again, writing this book, I just was chilled to the bone by how history repeats itself, including, as you said, with the language, the illegals, the undesirables. That those are the same words they used in World War II to describe Jews, political dissidents, you know, anybody they didn't like.
Yeah.
And war refugees, really.
Yeah. So this is a middle grade novel, and you write for primarily middle grade. This is a grim story. I mean, there are references to concentration camps and people, parents passing away in camps. And how do you make that, I don't want to say palatable, but appropriate for younger readers?
Well, kids are tough. And one thing I've always thought of is, you know, children know that there's a dark world out there. And what they need is not to be protected from that knowledge, but have the knowledge that they are empowered, that they can do something, that there is hope, that it's important not to lose hope. And that as long as you're alive, there's something you can do. And I feel like that is a more important message than just trying to sugarcoat or put under the rug the dark things that happen in history. I mean, that said, I would say that as a World War II story, there isn't very much violence in this. There's not really bloody battles. There's not people being dragged through the streets. There's reference to concentration camps, but we don't go in them. We hear secondhand about them. So there is a little bit of distance there.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of historical fiction for this age, young readers? What draws you to that?
Well, it's funny, you know, years ago, after my first novel, Heart of a Samurai, people said, why do you want to write historical fiction? And I was like, oh, is that what it is? I mean, I didn't, you know, of course I know what the historical fiction is. I just didn't know that's what I was writing. I just thought I was writing a story of a really interesting kid, another real person. I seemed to be drawn to the stories of real people. Then, you know, once I knew I was writing historical fiction, I thought about that because as a high school student, I didn't like history at all. But, you know, we've discussed the era in which I grew up, and my teacher was much older person, and she taught by names, places, and dates. You know, you had to memorize these things. So that's what I thought history was, until I started doing my own research and realizing, oh my gosh, you know, history is just full of incredible stories of ordinary people who do extraordinary things, which are, those are the people I'm just so drawn to. And this story, that Village of Scoundrels, is just filled with just ordinary kids who, because of the circumstances in which they find themselves, end up doing extraordinary things.
Yeah. And it's so, right now we're recording this on March 16th, and we are feeling the fear and effects of COVID-19 and the coronavirus. And I imagine it's a great time to read a book like this because
you.
Of so much of children doing extraordinary things in times of crisis, because we are in that unprecedented experience right now. What would you say to kids and readers in a time like this?
There's hope. Yeah. And yeah, don't lose hope. I think that is one reason why these young people were able to do what they did. And I should maybe point out to your listeners what they did, because we haven't really talked about what these young people were involved with. So because these Jewish kids from the concentration camps became illegal, they had to have false IDs to enable them to just exist. And so one young guy at age 17 started forging papers. And there were others too, other high school kids who participated in this forgery program. I don't know if that's what you call it. And then there was another young fellow, 17 years old, who helped smuggle people over the border to Switzerland, because obviously some people it just became too dangerous for a lot of these young people. Had to get out of the country to neutral Switzerland. And then another young woman who ended up, in spite of her great fear, this is a woman that I interviewed. She's still alive at 90 some advanced age. And she said she was very frightened, but she carried messages for the French resistance. And then she would also carry money and contraband and so on. For the groups that were organizing in the mountains around that village. So the kids were doing very dangerous occupations that they had gotten themselves into. And before that, they were just high school kids, really, just regular high school kids. So I guess in these similarly dark times, although dark for different reason, I think it's important to remind ourselves that there's something we can do. We can help others virtually, maybe, mm-hmm. Not face-to-face, just checking up on each other and keeping hope alive.
Yeah. I don't know about our audience, but I needed to hear that. So thank you. I want to change gears a little bit, because you do have such a great backlist too. So the other book that you mentioned that you would like to talk about is West of the Moon, because it's inspired by your great-great-grandmother's diary. I want to hear all about this book.
Well, my great-great-grandmother immigrated from Norway in 1851 as a young, brand new married. I think they got married and got on the boat. And it was a sailing ship before steamships even. And she kept a diary of her youth and their trip to America, and then continued it until she started having lots of children. And then, not surprisingly, her diary entries really dropped off. So some of your listeners will relate to that too, I'm sure. But in the diary, she mentions that she hires a maid on board the sailing ship that took them to America, a young girl who's traveling all alone with no family, no prospects in America, no one to meet her. And so I'm reading along thinking, who is this young girl all alone? What does she think she's going to do? Where are her parents? What, you know, what's her story? And suddenly I was more interested in this girl than I was in my great-great-grandmother. And so I decided to, so I kept reading the diary, hoping to learn more about her. And I learned a few things, but not very much about her background. So I kind of ended up making it up. Like, how did this girl end up on board this ship? And that gave me a lot more freedom than I had previously had in my novels, because as I mentioned, I had been writing about real people and had intended to, well, actually, this girl was a real person. In fact, it's interesting to know that at my book launch at Wild Rumpus in Minneapolis, a woman came up to me and introduced herself and said, "I am the great-great-granddaughter of the maid your great-great-grandmother hired." It was just, it was so astounding, and just a reminder of how stories do connect us across the ages even. So it was really cool to meet her, and she showed me pictures of her great-great-grandmother. So it's a real person, but a very fictional story that's very influenced by Scandinavian fairy tales, which I have a deep and abiding love for. And I think one of the reasons I love them so much is there are a lot of really spunky girls in those stories. It's often the girl who's rescuing the guy who's got himself into some kind of, he's been enchanted by some troll or other, and then, you know, become betrothed to a horrible troll, and the girl has to go rescue him. And even the stories where the girl, the princess, has been captured by a troll and the young intrepid boy comes to rescue her, she still tells him exactly what to do. You have to drink out of that flask over there, and then you can heft that sword there, and then stand here, and when the troll comes in, you can chop his head off. So I've always been very attracted to these young heroines of Scandinavian fairy tales. And reading my great-great-grandmother's diary, I ran into her own interestingly, I think, feminist point of view when, I don't have the book here. I would read the little quote. But she basically says, you know, I think anybody who tells girls that they shouldn't be independent, you know, is wrong. Young women should be independently minded. She also was very adamant that women should be educated and hated the fact that they weren't in Norway at that time. You know, they learned to read and play the piano.
What's the time period of your great-great-grandmother?
Yeah, well, she emigrated in 1851. So it's in the 1850s.
Wow. So she was ahead of her time.
Yeah. And she was a pastor's wife, and she got into trouble because she liked to sketch and read novels. Instead of doing housewifely duties, she'd be reading novels and making sketches. So she was sort of frowned upon for those activities.
Of course.
But I think she was quite a force. Her pastor husband had several parishes, so he basically traveled all the time. He was hardly ever home. He was always going from place to place and doing funerals and confirmation and weddings, and then next place doing that, and all around in the area. And so she ran the show at home. They had a you know, small farm, and she had a household and people visiting all the time. And the other interesting thing about pastors' wives, Scandinavian ones anyway, is they were assumed to have medical knowledge. And so all the farmers, and other working class people would come looking for medical help from the pastor's wife.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they gave it. I mean, they were at least educated, you know, so they had read things.
Yeah.
And they usually had, they usually possessed some basic medical things that you need, you know. I don't know what all they had, but probably lancing tools so they could bleed people. I don't know.
Oh, that makes it cringe.
Oh, yeah, they were doing that then.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. Well, we've come a long way, haven't we?
Yeah, it's true.
But despite all that, it's so incredible to read these stories from history. And I'm so grateful that there are authors like you writing these in an accessible way for our younger audiences. And I didn't know that this was that young adult, not young adult, but middle grade historical fiction was such a force to be reckoned with. I absolutely loved Village of Scoundrels. I tore through it. It's for a younger audience. It's hefty. It's, you know, almost 300 pages. And one of the things I did really appreciate is that you've got pronunciation guides for the French in it and some a glossary of French terms too. So even though my name is Renee, I can't speak a lick of French.
you appreciated that. Yes. And in the book, I may have sent you an ARC because the book maybe I hadn't gotten yet. In the actual book, there's also a list or cast of major characters. So because there are quite a number of characters, it helps. You can flip back if you are wondering, now who is that again? And then it gives you a little reminder of who each character, what they do, and how they were involved in this effort.
That's fantastic. There's also an epilogue of all of the real people too.
Yeah.
Oh, that is so fun to be able to read about them. And like you said, you spoke to the girl who ran messages for the
resistance. Well, it's interesting because I actually spoke to several people and I realized just before I was going to speak to you, they were all women.
Yeah.
And I think there were a lot of women involved, women and girls involved in this effort, partly because the men, like in one case, one of the women who was called the boss, because she was kind of in charge of the whole effort. Her husband was in England working with Charles de Gaulle, and she was at home raising 5 children and running a massive forgery, smuggling, you name it, effort to help these refugees. So, and she's not one that I interviewed, but I interviewed a woman who was sheltered in the village, Hannah, and her husband, Max. They met and fell in love in a French concentration camp and were extracted and sheltered in this village, and each had to make their way to Switzerland separately, but get smuggled into the country. So they have very dramatic stories to tell. And then the daughter of the pastor, who was also very involved, he kind of was a spiritual leader of the community. She lives not far from me, and now we've become great friends.
Wow.
Nellie Trockmay Hewitt. So she told me a lot of things. And the woman I mentioned earlier, who was a courier for the French resistance. And then one other woman who also was sheltered on the plateau on a farm. So it was very interesting to listen to their stories and inspiring.
Yeah, I actually, you mentioned the pastor, and I actually had a note. You share one of his sermons and how the community is kind of grappling with it. He says, the duty of Christians is to resist the violence directed at our consciences with weapons of the spirit. And I wrote, resistance is Christian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And this is part of the reason that this community really stepped up. They were Huguenot Protestants. And the Huguenots had been mercilessly persecuted by the Catholics in France in the 1600s, I think it was. And they'd been, tortured and run out of the country and killed and martyred and everything else. And so they had ended up in these kind of remote areas. And these little villages up on this high plateau, kind of out of the way, were perfect for their rescue operation, but they were inspired by their own story of persecution to help others who were persecuted. And that should be the lesson to all Christians, is that's what we're supposed to be doing.
Yes.
that should be our job.
It's the, like the pastor said, it is the requirement of the spiritual community. This is our spiritual requirement, to take care of everybody else and do what's right.
Right. And he also said, with the weapons of the spirit, I love that. He said, without fear, without hatred, without anger. Is that the other one?
I don't know. I shut the book.
Yeah. It's a very hopeful sermon that he delivered the day after the armistice was signed with Germany. So France had surrendered to Germany. Everyone was kind of like we are now. What is going to happen?
Yeah.
Are we all going to die? You know, that's where their heads were at. They'd seen enough of war already to be very afraid. And he gives this very hopeful and empowering sermon saying we can do something. We're not hopeless or helpless.
I think that's a beautiful note to end on, actually, that we can take with us for the rest of however many more weeks we're experiencing something harrowing. So thank you for that. I will link all of your books in the show notes, but if there's a way that we can stay in touch with you online, do you have a favorite way to do that?
Well, I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and I have a website.
Excellent.
Which is just my name, MargieParois.com.
All right. We will put those in the show notes as well. So be sure to check out all of those things. Give Margie a follow on all of those. And do you have a book that you would like to recommend to our audience that's not your own?
I read a fabulous book that I don't think very many people know about. If you're interested in this time period, it's called Sweet Frances, and it's by Irene, as we would say, Nemirovsky. And she was living during World War II. She's Jewish. She was living, I believe, in Paris. And I can't remember every detail of this, but she was writing a novel. And paper was so scarce that she was writing a tiny, tiny little hand and on in the margins, every square inch of the paper. She was deported and died at Auschwitz. Her daughters, who were children at the time, kept her notebooks and her manuscript for 60 years. Or maybe she was 60 when she decided she was going to get around now to looking at this stuff that her mother had written, which she thought had just been journaling. And it was so hard to read because it was such a tiny hand that she didn't want to make the effort, but she decided, okay, now I'm going to make the effort. And she started reading it and she was like, oh my, this is a novel. And it is a novel being written in real time as the war is unfolding. So she's writing about what is happening novelistically as it's happening. It's just the most remarkable thing. It's beautifully written.
What a treasure.
Yeah, so her daughter then had it published, and there it is. That's the book, Sweet Frances.
I will put that in the show notes, and I will check it out myself, because that sounds beautiful and so interesting. Margie, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing all of this insight on just hope during times of trouble. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks. It's been lovely talking with you.
We'll talk soon. Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.